Now we're going to hear from Daniel Ellsberg. Please. Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much. That was such a wonderful welcome here before. And Medea was saying to me, this is now the end of our tour, this particular week, 8 cities in 8 days, about 20 speeches. And she said, that was a very warm reception. And I said back to her, Medea, I've noticed in all these evenings that you get a standing ovation at the end of your talk. I noticed that. I'm sure she will inspire that again tonight. I have refused ever to follow Medea. That's why I'm in the middle. And we haven't spoken much in churches, although I'm very familiar with peace actions and peace gatherings in churches, for sure. But it reminded me, sitting here, in fact, I'm minded to tell some personal reflections here that my friends have not actually heard before in 8 days, I think. Going back, a particular occasion, going back to the 1991, just before the opening of the Gulf War, I should say before the opening of the ground part of the Gulf War, after 6 weeks of bombing, heavy bombing. If anything, my life work has been addressed to against strategic bombing, against the bombing of cities, against massacre from the air, above all, against nuclear weapons and the possibility they would ever be used again. In this bombing, we saw, as to some degree we saw again, a new refinement of strategic bombing in the era of CNN and a video, which is, don't use napalm and white phosphorus and burn the city down. Hit the water supplies, hit the electricity, turn the lights off, as they say, which means turn the electricity off for hospitals, for water purification, destroy the society afterwards, but in a way with precision missiles that just hits there and here, even though we now know that most of the weapons were in fact dumb bombs, so-called, which are the usual inaccuracy and the usual killing of civilians. But on the television, the impression was meant to be given that we're not doing that again. We're not doing what we did to Dresden and to Tokyo, even though the effect can be very similar. And of course, we saw exactly that again in Kosovo and to some degree in Baghdad. Anyway, that had been going on, and then a ground war was about to start, which I was sure would be accompanied by even greater bombing. And there was a talk in New York that I took part in with at Riverside Church, again a church. And at the end of it, those in the audience, in the congregation, did a march to Times Square, which, as I recall, is a long way, 40 blocks, 70 blocks somewhere. It's a long walk. And as we walked along, many people joined us at night. And windows opened, and people clapped, and people cheered, and people actually joined us. It was a marvelous, it was like that scene, if you've ever seen Viva Zapata, where everybody joining the march as you go along. And it was really a high, actually, to have this feeling of solidarity. And at the end of it, I took a hotel room in near Times Square, and somehow I was listening to the radio, and even more joyous news seemed to be that Saddam at that moment was at last belatedly buckling on the thing and offering to pull his troops out of Kuwait, but too late. Well, I should say, that seemed very good. In fact, I think we heard that on the march, which was cheering people up very much, so no need for a ground attack. But of course, Bush, the father, was determined to have that attack, that demonstration at that point. There was no stopping him, in fact. And to demonstrate, as Powell said, that on the ground, first we will cut their army off, then we will kill it. That's Secretary of State Powell, who was then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So there was, as I say, brief elation that this was unnecessary, and then in the morning it became clear that Bush was going to go ahead. He rejected the offer. Too late, we don't believe it, etc. I was very depressed at that, and I thought, a thought came into my mind, this is a time I want to be in jail. I want to be protesting this, whatever, in what way I can. I want to say, this is not with my consent. I'm going to go to Washington. I was sure there would be people in front of the White House, as there were. And I went to Washington on the shuttle that morning. had been invited to go already to a group that was meeting for the long-term strategies during the long war. And that too was in a church. And I was led to say, as I'm going to say tonight, something I've hardly said in between, and I'd never said before. I'm a Jew who was raised as a Christian. And I'm not a Christian anymore. I'm an ex-Christian in religion, not an ex-Jew. But for many years, I thought of myself as having no religion. But a community of nonviolent resistance like ours, to be a community, to be effective, we have to be a community. And communities need rituals, traditions and rituals to bind them together. And I realized that for me, nonviolent civil disobedience has become my religious ritual, my religious observance. I then went and joined the people in just in front of Lafayette Square, and about the time that the ground offensive started, we got arrested and we went to jail. Okay, fast forward now over years of sanctions. The reason I was so concerned about the war, the ground offensive at that time, was that I was sure that they would not stop short of Baghdad. And although it was already clear that the bombing, in this case, of the desert, where the troops were in Kuwait, had been very lethal, it wasn't clear right away how lethal it had been. The desertions, the threat, and so forth, did make the ground war much faster and more effective, quote, from our point of view, than I expected. But I did expect it to go on to Baghdad. That's what the Center for Defense Information, retired generals and admirals, were all predicting. And I didn't think they'd stop short of that. I did not want to find out how the Iraqi troops fought in their own country, where they would not be in trenches and tunnels where they could easily be found in the desert and the B-52s could slaughter them, but where they would be fighting in the cities, in their own hometowns. I didn't want to find that out. Having been in Vietnam, where the ambushes had been in the jungle, and there was no jungle here, but it wasn't a flat desert in their own country, in Iraq, as we know, much more varied terrain, but the cities above all were, I was afraid, going to be defended by Iraqis in a way that we would be led to wipe them out and to suffer many casualties ourselves in the process. So I was extremely against that. And as we heard from Kerry last night, interestingly, in a telling point, he quoted Bush's father as the reasons why he didn't do that. And I do give Bush credit for not doing that, and I'd say there's two factors. There's the practical factor that he saw the reality that was not hard to see for anybody, that it would set the Middle East on flame, it would lose the alliance, we would be alone in that situation, we would have the hostility of the Muslim world, we would be facing an insurgency, which was predicted to him, we now know, to this Bush, by CIA on the eve of the invasion this time. All of these things were predicted on January of 2003, just before the campaign, and that was leaked just a week ago, when the Wall Street Journal had an editorial last Wednesday complaining about the CIA leaking these truths. It's a rebellion against the president, a kind of mutiny, which I really hope it is, and I think it is to some extent. But at any rate, he had realistic reasons for not doing this, plus the fact, as I say, he was going to lose the allies, which he didn't want to do, cause this hostility and so forth, and one other fact, not mentioned by Bush and Scowcroft in their account of why they ended even the air war, the ground war in the end, after 100 hours with the pictures, photographs of that murderous highway, what do they call it, the highway of blood or something, showing where we were shooting people on their retreat, slaughtering them. Those pictures caused them to stop that. Why? Because they couldn't stand the pictures? No. Because that war had had the biggest anti-war movement before a war the world had probably ever seen. I, myself, in Washington, talked to 250,000 people just after the bombing had started. It had been scheduled before that. That happened to be the largest crowd I'd ever been in front of. I wasn't at the largest demonstrations in Vietnam or in the anti-nuclear movement. And this was immense, you know, enormous. True, it faded away fast when the war started, in effect. the marchers didn't fade away, but the public support faded away, and we had to realize there's a lot of us, we are a minority, and you can emphasize one way or the other on this. It became clear we were a minority, the people who couldn't accept this would be active against it and so forth. The other side was there were a lot of us, and although we didn't stop the war, I believe that we played a major part in stopping the invasion of Iraq. At a time, by the way, when Saddam did have WMDs, not only deployed, they were on his missiles, weaponized, we now know, pointed toward Tel Aviv, to which the Israelis, if they'd used them, threatened to reply with nuclear weapons. So I think the anti-war movement at that time, which looked, of course, as though it had had no effect, 6 weeks later, and by the end of the war, they had stopped the war in a way that enraged many people, civilians, in the administration under Cheney, specifically Wolfowitz, Pearl, the people who were back, Fife, Bolton, all these people, said, terrible mistake has been made by Powell, the president, Scowcroft, Schwarzkopf, to stop this offensive. He should have gone to Baghdad. At a time, as I say, when their army was in full strength, not full, but very large after the war, their main Revolutionary Guard division still intact. They did have the chemical and biological weapons then. They did have a nuclear weapons program then, though they didn't last. And that's when they wanted to attack. Bush knew better. Because Bush was a genius and Bush deserved the Nobel Peace Prize? No. But because Bush was not crazy. Looking back over the last 75 years, 100 years, I don't think there's any group, Republican or Democrat, that we've seen running for office or in office, who would have used 9/11 as an excuse and an opportunity for invading Iraq. Even weakened as it was, greatly weakened. They were right in thinking that the first blitzkrieg phase would be easier than it would have been 10 years earlier after the sanctions and the war, before the sanctions and the war. Weaker. But in a world where 9/11 had just shown us that the hostility of a Muslim world this would evoke would be expressed immediately by recruiting for a genuine enemy, Al-Qaeda, a genuine threat that had just shown itself as a threat, a stateless threat against the U.S. and its forces elsewhere, and whose recruiting would inevitably be strengthened by an invasion of a Muslim country. As Richard Clark said, it was as if Osama bin Laden were exercising mind control from a cave in Afghanistan on Bush, saying, you must invade Iraq, please invade Iraq. And Clark was mocked for that. Is he mad? He's, you know, Californian here, channeling. No, it's perfectly similar. Bush was acting as if he were totally coordinated with bin Laden, and he still is acting that way, totally. He's obviously bin Laden's candidate for life, I'm sure, for no reason. Okay, so again, this is the scene, because they had been planning this, as we now know, for over a dozen years, since 1991, since Bush Sr. failed to go into Baghdad. This little team had been planning that and went ahead with the team, seeing 9/11 as an opportunity rather than as a turnoff for this, because we're in an era where that was uniquely dangerous in a way that Vietnam War, horrible and murderous and criminal as it was not dangerous to us at home in the way that this war is dangerous every week it continues. And it's going to continue a long time, I'm afraid. Many factors will, I hope, cause it to end. We'll be working at it, but it will be a matter of pressing the next president, and the question is, which president? I don't think Bush would be any more resilient or any more responsive to pressure from allies or from us in changing these plans, which go beyond Iraq, to Syria, Iran, even Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere. That's part of the plan that's in their planning, and the same team that has failed so horribly, so terribly in this world, the Wolfowitz, Pearl, Rumsfeld, Cheney team, are all still there, despite Abu Ghraib, despite all the wrong predictions. They're all still there, and they will be there in the second term, except for Powell, who turned too dovish for them. And will be out. So that's on the one hand. The president I hope to oppose an anti-war movement is Kerry, for a number of reasons, many of which you've heard from Norman, you'll hear more from him, from Medea. In many ways, the opposition will not be so strong. I hope we won't have to oppose and filibuster ourselves his Supreme Court appointments. That's left for the Republicans. His environmental policy won't be perfect, but it will be incredibly better than we have now, or would have under Bush. In many respects, incomparably better. In some, not so much better. In Iraq itself, as opposed to invading all these other places, not so different in the short run, I'm afraid. That's terrible. I heard him the other night. You heard him the other night. In effect, he promised to keep at it, to win the war. He should know better than that. I hope he does know better than that. I hope he's lying in political sense and means to change that as soon as he's actually in office. Not an unreasonable hope, but I'm not as hopeful about that as I was a month or two ago. I think he may actually mean what he says and think that he can win it, which is, of course, totally ignoring his Vietnam experience, I'm very sad to say. I just hope that doesn't work. The war is not any more winnable than was Vietnam. The ambushes in the cities are not going to go away any more than the ambushes in the jungle, and of course that reflects the fact of a people more or less united against foreign occupation, whether or not they really sympathize. Whether or not they sympathize at all with the tactics, the terrorist tactics. The VC, of course, also used terrorist tactics, and many Vietnamese weren't happy about that either. But they're not going to inform on them. They're not going to tell the occupier who's lurking for them in order so that their brothers and cousins and daughters can be destroyed by us before the ambush. They're not going to do that. So the war is going to go on as long as we're there. It's not going to be won. I'm counting on Kerry to bend that reality in a way that I would never expect Bush to do it, and to listen to the allies. That, I think, will make a big difference, actually, from Bush, and to listen to us, ultimately, and our effort will be called for. I asked for that time, but I'm to be signally given, but I'm... May I go on a little bit longer than finish this? May I? I don't know. I'll ask the audience. Let's be done. Democracy, right? You outvoted them. I don't know. Whatever. A few more minutes. Because what I was leading to really was another experience of dealing with, not in this case in a church, but with ministers and rabbis and nuns. The nuns were in a different cell. And priests in front of the UN just before this war started. And they were passing around the night before. It was to be an action of persons of faith. And they pushed around a clipboard the night before to sign your name and address. Persons of faith taking part in the action should sign their names. And I didn't know at first whether I should sign this or not. I was one of a couple ringers there. My son was there with me, my younger son. This was his first arrest, actually. And he's 27, gotten that far. But Ben Cohen was there. He was another ringer, non-minister. But anyway, somebody then came up to me and said, "Are you a person of faith?" And I said, "I don't know if I'm a person of faith, but I'm a person of hope." And in the course of that, by the way, you meet wonderful people in these cells. I was just reflecting on the fact that I was talking to one other person that I assumed was a minister and gave his name, which actually I forget. Maybe somebody here knows it. And I said, "And what do you do? Or where are you? What is your congregation?" He said, "I'm the General Secretary of the Communist Party, USA. I said, "Wow." I was really, this was now, 2003. I was thinking, wow. I said, "You are a person of faith." And finally, the last connection here that I wanted to pay tribute to. One of the later arrests was just at the start of the days of awe, the shock and awe treatment. And I'd come to Washington, and I'd agreed to take part in a Code Pink action, which, as usual, I was late to. So I got to the intersection in front of the White House, and there were a bunch of people lying in pink, in a circle sort of, on the ground, but surrounded totally by police. I had a very heavy cordon of police around them. And didn't seem any way to get through. I sort of tried to muscle a little bit, but nothing. So then somebody came up to me, all in pink, but looking like an invalid or a corpse or something, filled covered with blood, and starts, "Hi, Dan," you know, and so forth. And I, "Yes." And he said, "That's Medea, it's Medea." And I said, she said, "Come down here," come down, we were on one side of the street, "come down past these buses here that were lined up, and cross the street the other way, and come in from the other side." So I did that, and I found it was at an intersection, and at one point, a car came by, and the police opened for just a minute to let this thing by. So I slipped through the police, and I lay down on the way in, fearing they're going to catch me. It's going to be very undignified here. They're going to grab me as I make a flying leap on this bunch of bodies. But they let me go. Once I was there, they let me stay. So we went. We got taken to a police academy, actually. Seen the movie? This is the police academy here in D.C., and they practiced their anti-terrorist techniques on it, trussing us up in ways that I'd never experienced before. 60 or so arrests, you know, hog-tied like this, and they were really practicing tight. In the course of it, I realized, I said, most people pled out, what sort of signed out, you know, on kind of a slip, because they had other actions to do, and there was a teaching the next day, and demonstrations and so forth, and then I thought, the shock and awe is due tomorrow. And actually, if I leave, as everybody was leaving, I will not want to watch that. I won't be able to stand it. I think I might go crazy. And what can I do? I could go to a movie or something. But then I would feel like, you know, an evader somehow. And if I watch it, I don't think I can stand it. What's about to happen to Baghdad in the next 48 hours? So I said, no, I won't sign out. I said, well, you've got to sign out, you know, stay here. This was a Friday. They said, well, there's no judge, they said, so you'll have to stay until Monday. I said, that's all right. That was just when I wanted to stay in, Monday or Tuesday. And there was a teaching I was supposed to speak at the next day. I told one of the people leaving, tell them that I can't come. I'm in a secure location. And I chained during the whole Vietnam War. And I have other priorities. They said, why are you doing this? What's up? And I didn't give them an answer particularly. And finally I said to one the truth. I said, I don't want to watch the television for the next 2 or 3 days. And he said, hell, we'll put you in a cell block with television. Oh, that's a threat. You know, so. But they didn't do that, actually. And when they took me to another jail, the thought was in my mind at that point. This is what I wanted to come to. The thought was in my mind from Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience. What is the, in a country that jails anyone unjustly, what is the proper place for a just man but in jail? That is where this was during the Mexican War, by the way, which he was protesting. That's how he spent his night in jail, which would have been longer, except somebody against his will bailed him out, paid the fine, the poll tax. And he said it is in jail, it's there that the Mexican deserter from the Mexican War, it is there that the Indian come to plead the wrongs of his race, the slave, the fugitive slave, should find him in jail. And he then said one other thing right after that. People, he said, who oppose the war and slavery in principle but do nothing of effect to change it. At most, they cast a cheap vote. He said, cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence. A minority, and we are a minority anyway, kind of big or small, in this country. A minority is powerless when it conforms to the majority. It is not even a minority then, but it is irresistible when it clogs by its whole weight. And so I thought, good, they put me in this cell. But on the way there, again, another policeman said, why are you doing this? Can't you afford bail? And I said, no, I have the money. And he said, why are you doing this? I said, well, I read a book once. I said, really? This guy was about 25. Policeman. And I was stressing me up again. And I said, yeah, have you ever heard of Thoreau? He said, no. And I said, so I wrote out, I told him to write down, I was handcuffed, Essay on Civil Disobedience. It's a good book to write. And it was a better place to be. I lay in the cells, and Thoreau described it, a hard bench. And I found I was ashamed for my country. And I wanted to be either on the moon or in jail during that. How do you cast your whole vote now? Not this month, I think, by civil disobedience. I don't think anyone has any political activity to do better than working this month to oust this regime at the end of this month. I just can't imagine what could be more important politically than doing that, than working to do it. If, last thought here, if the man in this election who speaks for me in program is Ralph Nader, before it was Kucinich, I backed Kucinich through the convention. But on program, and I agree with everything that Nader has been saying, I heard him the other day on tape in KPFK, except when he says, vote for me in a swing state. And he was talking from Florida. I think that's extremely bad advice. And the people in this room are big enough to throw, if the 6 or 8 point lead dissolves of Perry, as it did in Tennessee, they had an 8 point lead at this state right up to the last of the election in Tennessee, and he lost that state. This is not a state that can be called clearly a safe state. Two states were won by 600 votes or less, another by 2,000 or so. The people in this room could throw this state to Bush by staying home or by encouraging others to vote for a third-party candidate. Or they could win the election and beat Bush and get them out of power. That doesn't leave, I think, a whole lot of responsible choice here. Supposing the election is stolen, as people say, then we're back to Thoreau. I was realized when Norman said we're in Seattle, we're in Seattle, right? That's tonight, we're in Seattle. Seattle is the home of the general strike, and that's what should happen today. If this election is stolen, we should all work that this country stops working.